Good morning. If it pleases the court, I will go right to the issues unless there's some questions about the facts. Steve Chestnut and the other plaintiffs have raised two important issues. The first issue is an evidence issue, the exclusion of comment or inquiry into the 1996 police brawl. We were prohibited by Judge Tinder's ruling in a motion in limine not to allow any questioning of Sergeant Hall or Mr. Tootsie. This essentially tied one arm of the plaintiff behind his back. Tootsie was implicated in the assault of two civilians along with 14 other police officers.
Don't I understand that all he did in this case was relay information? He was not a participant.
He was not a participant, but his statement...
He relayed information.
He relayed information, but he was the information giver. He was not even an eyewitness.
I know.
And his credibility has to be the basis for Officer Hall believing or acting on it. Like any officer, he doesn't just come to the scene with anybody calling in 911 or calling in information. He has to have some experience with that person in order to determine whether it's trustworthy.
I understand that you would suggest that it would be appropriate for the receiving officer to not to act on information from another officer based on the fact that he wouldn't believe him?
If this officer believed the officer based upon some experience, then there'd be no question. But if this officer, if I may finish, Judge, if this officer has...
I wasn't interrupting you. You interrupted me, but go ahead.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do that. I thought you were finished.
I was. Go ahead.
Okay.
Let it out.
Officer Hall stated that he had experience with Mr. Tootsie, and because of that experience, he was trustworthy and reliable. But Officer Hall was on the force for...
Is that on direct examination?
On the record, the direct examination. And Officer Hall was on the force in 1996. This was a running front page story in which Tootsie was forced to resign because he was implicated in battering and assaulting two civilians and covering it up. That front page story was certainly known by everybody. And in fact, one of the officials of Overnight commented in a letter to the police department, "All I read about national coverage was the police brawl. When Sergeant Hall presented himself, I was very impressed with his professionalism." What we wanted to do was ask Sergeant Hall, if you really think he's reliable, then how do you take into account the fact that he was terminated or forced to resign from the police department? How do you take into account that he had a reputation for confrontation and deception?
Mm.
We weren't allowed to do that. And it seems to me that we could have been instructed to carefully explore that issue without prejudicing the jury in that direction. You have to realize that when Sergeant Hall came there, it didn't appear as if he was coming to investigate. We believe he had other motives. He didn't take names. He didn't verify the information by going up to the guardhouse. He didn't even file a report. It seems to us that what his motive was harassment. And because we could not explore his reliance on this information coming from Tootsie, which was at least 2 to 3 hours old, and information which he did not personally observe, seems to me we had a right to explore this relationship, which he said was based upon his experience most recently and did not allow us to explore his relationship earlier. We think that ruling really handicapped us because credibility of Tootsie and, of course, credibility of Hall really hinge on what we were able to ask them about their relationship with each other. Because when Hall came there, he had no other information about the events except what Mr. Tootsie gave him. He didn't know who was there. He didn't know exactly what was going on. And I might point out that it was so vague that even at the close of most of the evidence, the attorneys for the police officers were still calling this a criminal trespass investigation. And only upon some inquiry during the jury instruction discussion did we realize, or did we point out, that as the plaintiffs point out, there was no information about criminal trespass, hence the instruction was converted to something having to do with criminal misdemeanor. We believe that is really all I can say about that. We were prejudiced. The court made an honest ruling, but we think the court was wrong and it's handicapped. And here's why it's most important. Because the rest of this case is about who has the burden of proof. Now imagine, if you will, that the plaintiff now has to disprove the three negatives, that is the exceptions to the warrant requirements under the Fourth Amendment. And I might point out that if there's any importance to the sequence, persons comes before house. So the cases that are often discussed have to do with an invasion of a house without a warrant, and the courts have unfortunately sort of blurred or merged the discussion about exigency and probable cause. which was highlighted, I believe, in the Lugano case. But in any event, if the plaintiff has the burden of showing these three negatives, then how can they do that when you start to handicap them with rules? I would like to point out, for example, that not only were the plaintiffs required to prove the negatives, but instruction actually told the jury that they must listen to and regard the subjective impressions of the officer at the scene, not even a reasonable offer. Calling your attention, if I might, just read briefly, judges to Rule 23, or I'm sorry, Instruction 23. When determining whether exigent circumstances existed, you must analyze the situation from the perspective of the officers at the scene, not a reasonable officer, but the officers at a scene. It goes on to admonish them that you must defer to them. Accordingly, you are not to ask what the police officers could have done, but rather whether they had, at the time, a reasonable belief that there's a compelling need to act and no time to secure a search warrant.
Well, there it said reasonable need, didn't it?
I'm sorry?
There it said reasonable need, didn't it?
Well, reasonable need from the perspective of the officer.
Well, see, it's always from the perspective of the officer. It's the predicate for exigent entry in any of the Fourth Amendment cases.
I think in terms of probable cause, though, usually you're talking about what a reasonable police officer, you're at least entitled to talk about what a reasonably well...
What's the difference between having a reasonable belief or being a reasonable police officer?
Well, in this particular case, it's not a reasonable police officer, it's this particular...
Yeah, I know, but what's the difference between somebody having a reasonable belief as an individual and having a reasonable belief as a police officer? I don't understand the distinction.
Well, because police officers have training and standards, they more than...
A reasonable belief is a reasonable belief, no matter who holds it.
No, I disagree with that, respectfully. Because
that's all right. You can disagree. You lose, of course, but you can disagree.
Well, I'm here to disagree. Obviously, we're trying to change your mind. Now, I would call your attention, for example, to the Lugano case, which was the 1985 case. It was not even cited by the judge, Revner, in the Valence case, which is now seemingly controlling. And I might point out that the Valence case is really only talking about consent. It's not talking about the burden of proof on the other two exceptions, namely exigent circumstances and a police officer's need to conduct a pat-down in order to ensure his own safety. So she doesn't even talk about one of the most significant cases in the Seventh Circuit, and I might point out that there were five opinions in that. So it was extensively discussed. It was not routinely or easily resolved. There were five different opinions. The leading opinion, the majority opinion, was written by Judge Posner. A dissenting and concurring opinion actually prophesied the problems that we're going to have. It goes on to say, the essence of Judge Posner's opinion, as I read it, is simply that when you are short on probable cause, you can make up that shortage by adding exigent circumstances. I cannot accept that dangerous, unnecessary, and undefinable blending of two separate and useful traditional concepts in order to justify a warrantless search. Now,
was Judge Posner in the majority in that case?
He was in the majority. And I'm reading from the dissent, which also concurred. I might point out that in the discussion of the law in the circuit, it is clear that exigent circumstances never exist when you're talking about minor offenses. And I would refer the court to the opinion written, I think, again by Judge Posner when he talks about the Walsh case and says minor offenses never allow for exigent circumstances. In this case, we have a police officer coming to the scene and insisting on the three exceptions, namely that he's entitled to search because of first permission. If that doesn't work, we're going to try a need to pat down for our own safety, and if that doesn't work, we're going to talk about exigent circumstances. Now, mind you, he doesn't go to the guardhouse to ask any questions. Now, what are the exigent circumstances? Under normal misdemeanor circumstances, you would say, you go up to the guard, you say, did you see it? Good, I want you to fill out an affidavit. We'll go down to the magistrate, and we'll see if we can identify the specific people. The information that he had to the scene, he had when he came to the scene, did not give him names, did not give him times, and it did not give him much of in the way of circumstances. Under the rule, as this court has enunciated or seems to be instructing the trial courts to follow, it would permit a police officer on hearsay or secondhand information to go to a concert on the suspicion that somebody at that concert is smoking a marijuana cigarette. And because of exigent circumstances, which he has now invented or created, he can now say, I'm entitled to search every one of you people coming through this gate to see if I can preserve that marijuana cigarette. I think that's clearly unreasonable. I think that's unbelievable.
As you described it, so do I. So we at least found one thing.
Well, I'm glad we agree on that, Judge. But that's the rule that we have here. This person, that is Sergeant Hall, comes to the scene. He searches everybody there. He searches a visitor who's just there as a social guest, talking to somebody, doesn't ask anybody's name, doesn't even make a report. That's not an investigation. That's harassment. And he, according to the testimony, acknowledges that, or according to the testimony of Steve Chestnut. I'm just doing this so I can tell Overnight Trucking that I've searched one of their union attorneys. So in this situation, we believe that the court has
the union attorney invited the search, didn't he?
Well, that's the testimony of Sergeant Hall. And again, the burden is now on the plaintiff to say it didn't happen. Now, how do you disprove the negative? Sorry?
The jury believed him.
We don't know that. There are three reasons. There are three reasons that they can allow for the search. Any of those three would allow for the search. We don't know whether the jury disbelieved the first one, disbelieved the second one, or disbelieved the third one. They could have believed all three, that the officer was entitled to do all three things. We don't know. But the burden was on the plaintiff. And what I'm trying to say in the brief time that I have here, it's an impossible burden. This court is going to abrogate the Fourth Amendment.
Wasn't objection made to these jury instructions?
Sorry?
Wasn't objection made to these jury instructions?
There are some technical issues about procedure, Judge. Yes, I'm answering the question. They were objected to. Could I have done a better job?
The jury instructions that were actually given were objected to. The position in your brief was that you had objected to some similar proposals.
That's correct.
But not to the ones actually given.
One of them yes, one of them no. So you're correct. We had to go back and make what we could out of a record in which there was a discussion billed as a pretrial conference, which we were going to discuss in jury instructions. I see the light on it. If you would like me to answer, I'd be glad to.
I don't understand, since there's no plain error doctrine for jury instructions in civil cases, I don't understand how we can reach the technical correctness of a jury instruction that was not objected to.
We objected to almost an identical instruction tendered by the defendant. And it also...
Do you have any authority for the proposition that objecting to an instruction similar to the one given preserves an objection to the one actually given?
I don't have any authority on that exact point, but I don't think you have to be redundant.
The rule is specific. It says you have to object to the one given, not to something similar.
That is the rule. But the process does not give you much time, Judge, if I might point out. Normally, you brief these things...
I can understand proposals to change the rules, but the rules are what the rules are, and we apply them.
I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Very good. I thank you, Stone. Mr. McQuarrie?
Your Honors, if it pleases this court, my name is Jeff McQuarrie, and I represent the defendant police officers. This is an appeal from a jury verdict in which the jury found for the defendants. Plaintiffs raised two issues on appeal. First, they argue that they were prejudiced to a degree requiring reversal in a new trial by an evidentiary ruling excluding a line of cross-examination about a witness's past misconduct by a witness who is not a party, was not present at the time of the search, and in fact did not witness any of the events that give rise to this lawsuit. Second, plaintiffs complained that they were prejudiced to a degree requiring reversal and new trial by jury instructions to which they did not object. Regarding...
Well, it says he objected to one of the instructions. Is that true?
Your Honor, it is not true. The plaintiff objected to similar language in proposed
instruction. He said he objected to one similar, but he said he objected specifically to one instruction that was given. I think that's what I heard, anyway.
Certainly what he said.
My understanding of the record, Your Honors, is that the plaintiff objected to the legal principle that was later embodied in instruction 23, but of course at the time, at the pretrial conference, instruction 23 did not exist yet, and so it cannot be said that he objected to instruction 23, although we did have a discussion.
So from your reading of the record, there was no time when he specifically objected to any of the instructions that were given?
Yes, Your Honor. Regarding Paul Tutsi, plaintiffs were not prejudiced by their by Judge Tinder's ruling that they could not inquire on cross-examination into his participation in the Meridian Street police brawl. They were not prejudiced for the simple reason that Paul Tutsi's veracity is irrelevant. This is a lawsuit regarding the reasonableness of a search. Paul Tutsi did not witness the search. The jury reached its decision after viewing videotapes that captured all but 30 to 60 seconds of the incident. After viewing those tapes, they found in favor of the police officers. Paul Tutsi did not witness any part of that incident. Paul Tutsi's veracity is relevant at most to the issue of probable cause. Did Paul Tutsi's phone call to Sergeant Hall put Sergeant Hall in a state of mind that he had probable cause to conduct the search? But probable cause is only one of the three justifications that the officers have given for their actions. At trial, and indeed throughout the litigation of this case, the officers' primary justification has been consent, that Steve Chestnut told Sergeant Hall, "You can search me, you can search the trailer too." Paul Tutsi's veracity will shed no light on the primary factual dispute in this trial, which was whether or not the Teamsters consented to be searched. Although the inquiry into the police brawl will not shed any light on the main factual dispute in this case, it will work a substantial prejudice against the defendants by allowing the plaintiffs to raise the topic of police misconduct in the police brawl. The police brawl was a highly publicized event. Mayor Goldsmith attributed this to this incident his inability to win the governor's office in the year 96. This is an event that would almost certainly be remembered by the jurors. I'd like to remind the court that this court reviews evidentiary rulings on a highly deferential standard of abuse of discretion, given the minimal evidentiary value of Paul Tutsi's credibility and the substantial prejudice that a discussion of the police brawl would work against the defendants. It cannot be said that the district court abused its discretion. This court will reverse on an evidentiary ruling only when no reasonable person could take the same view as the district court, and given the prejudice in this case, that simply is not the case. Turning to the jury instructions, as Your Honors have noted, plaintiff did not object to the instructions actually given. Indeed, in their brief, plaintiffs concede that they did not object to the instructions. Therefore, the issue has been waived on appeal. But at least regarding instruction 23, plaintiffs have attempted to escape the waiver by attempting to bring into the record discussions that took place at a pretrial conference at which, among many other things, the jury instructions were discussed. This court should not permit that. Appellate Rule 10C, by its own plain language, applies only to trials and hearings. The pretrial conference was neither a trial nor a hearing. Trials and hearings are occurrences that parties understand to be on the record. This pretrial conference was an event that neither party considered to be on the record.
Mr. McCurry, the court appreciates that. Did there come a time, and does the record reflect, that the judge, when all the proposed instructions were assembled, gave an opportunity to both sides to, number by number, object to the instructions?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's to be found in the record?
Yes, Your Honor.
And when it came to the specific instructions in question here, it is your belief that the record reflects no objection during that recorded session?
Yes, Your Honor. There was an objection to a different aspect of instruction 23.
What do you mean a different aspect?
Throughout the trial, the defendant...
The criminal trespass one?
Yes, Your Honor. This is the discussion alluded to earlier. The word criminal trespass was not used. The counsel asked that we substitute the word vandalism, a suggestion that the defendant thought was entirely helpful. The issue raised on appeal was not objected to.
Well, the record will reflect that a number, the instruction and its number was called.
Yes,
and,
Your Honor.
And we'll show no objection when we get to the specific instructions.
No objection to the issue raised on appeal. There was an objection.
The one you've talked about was affected. The objection of the use of the term criminal trespass, criminal damage exchange trespass.
Yes, that was objected to.
That was the only objection?
That I can recall, Your Honor. There was no objection to the issue raised on appeal, to the issue that they now raise.
That you now recall?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there a possibility there is an objection?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. No, sir.
Okay, I'm sorry. Judge Flaw.
No, that's fine. Well, the record is what it is, and we rely heavily on counsel when they're making arguments here to be the masters of the record. We hope to become that quite often afterward. So it's important that both counsel accurately represent to us what the record is, because that's something you clearly can prepare for. Whatever the law may or may not be as we interpret it, that's obviously a different issue. So, but we'll find what the record says. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Would add that even if the court deems that these instructions were properly objected to, both instructions correctly state the law. Instruction 20 correctly allocates the burden of proof to disprove exceptions to the warrant requirement to the plaintiff in a civil suit. This is the law that this court has announced in Valence v. Withell. Although plaintiffs have advanced some reasons that the court might reconsider that ruling, jury instructions are viewed, again, on a highly deferential standard of abuse of discretion. In no sense could...
I don't understand that. Whether a jury instruction correctly states the law is a question of law. We don't review that deferentially. The argument being made here is the jury instruction did not correctly state the law. Why should our review be deferential?
Your Honor, that is the announced standard. Obviously,
So our review is not deferential.
It would not defer to a plainly erroneous statement of law.
No, it doesn't defer to an erroneous. Right? Deference just doesn't have anything to do with what does the law require.
Deference would require this court to view the instruction in the light favorably when it asks, has the jury been misled? Could the instruction have stated the law somewhat more precisely? Certainly, a deferential standard of review would not require, could not allow this court to overlook a plainly erroneous statement of the law. However, on the question of whether an instruction could be slightly misleading, I think the standard of review would require the court to looking at the instructions as a whole, not penalize the district court for an attempt to summarize in instructions intended for to be
read
by people.
You know, you'd be better off just hanging on to the argument that the instructions correctly state the law and let it go at that.
Well, that is our position, Your Honor.
And talking about deference doesn't have much to do with reality, does it?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Instruction 23, I would like further add, also incorrectly states the law. It is the position of this court as announced in Jacobs v. City of Chicago. And last, Your Honors, I'd like to turn to some of the analogies that counsel raised. The one analogy was that if there is a concert with a large number of people and a claim that one person was smoking a marijuana cigarette, does the law, as embodied in Instruction 23, allow the police officer to search everyone at this concert?
Depend on whether everybody in the crowd was acting in concert.
Well, Your Honor, I think it depends.
I'm not sure I'm going to put up with that. But go ahead.
on whether there is some particularized suspicion. In this case, the police officers went to the scene of the incident, the driveway to a truck depot in a deserted area of an industrial section of Indianapolis on a cold December night. The first thing the officers asked them is, "How long have you been here?" And they replied, "We've been here for many hours, including the time of the alleged incident." They were in control of the premises at the time of the alleged misconduct. Therefore, the officers had some particularized suspicion that the people there were the ones who committed the crime. In that respect, the facts of this case differ from the analogies that plaintiff has raised. In plaintiff's analogies, there is a huge crowd with no rational reason to single out the individual searched. In the case at bar, there was a tiny number of people in a deserted area in control of the premises where the alleged misconduct occurred, and therefore they had probable cause to believe that those individuals may have dropped nails on the driveway. Thank you, Your Honors.
No. Thank you, Mr. Carey. Mr. Sutherland?
2 minutes.
I appreciate the admonition, Judge Flom. I want to be precise. We did object to that instruction. I think Mr. McQuarrie is correct. What we said in our brief, in our reply brief, is that we felt at that point we had already made our objections, both to the defense instructions, we had made our objections, or we had offered our own instructions, which we thought were the correct discussion of the law.
Perhaps you could just take a second or two to tell me how Judge McKinney conducts this instruction conference. Do you stand before him or in chambers that recorded? How does this come about?
It's Judge Tinder in this.
Excuse me, Judge Tinder. I apologize.
Yeah, and he's a good judge. There's no problem with that. He typically this is how he does it typically. He would invite us over, which we thought was a pretrial conference for purposes of addressing the objections to the various instructions offered by either side. That's what we thought we were coming over there. And in many instances, that is recorded. In fact, he apologized for not having a court reporter there. Whether it's necessary to be recorded, I don't know, but that's what he...
I mean, just before jury submission,
yes.
Do you have an opportunity, as the record should reflect, a cataloging of the instructions to be given and an opportunity to both sides to make a final comment? Well, I appreciate that you may have suggested that a theme running through instructions is inappropriate, but I there comes a time, or should come a time, when the opportunity is given to both sides to object, and that's what I'm really focusing on.
And I'll be glad to help you out on that. Here's what happens on this. You're going through the trial. You do not have the court's jury instructions during the case in chief. At some point towards the end, and oftentimes it's right at the point where you're going to break to go do your last-minute revisions on your closing argument. He says, I'll have them for you in a minute so you can incorporate them in your closing argument. You come back, and you're given whatever time he thinks is necessary, but you're not given a lot of time to go through that. And that's the first time you see his final instructions. And there are, whatever there are, but there are about 40
And at that time, you get to comment on the instructions.
Yes, sir. You have the opportunity, if you want, to go through each one of those. Now, of course, the problem is that we have objected, and it starts running together. We have objected in a pretrial conference to the instructions. And the court, I understand why you're bowing your head down, Judge Fama.
Well, it's not helpful to us if at the trial setting, if procedures become less than rigorous when it comes time to preserve that which we are called to address. I'm not here to assess fault at this moment on the procedure, but it is essential, and incumbent on counsel. And if indeed counsel is under some gun, figuratively speaking, and there is a sense that an approach to the law has not been appropriately applied in the creation of the instructions, the final instructions by the court, counsel really needs to say, I need more time.
Yeah. No, it's my observation, my responsibility.
Or both sides. To be comfortable for the purposes of incorporating it into your argument to the extent that that's appropriate.
I understand. But I do also believe, Judge, if we tender an instruction that's rejected and we preserve that objection, then we think that's the correct statement of the law, we ought to be able to argue, and we are arguing, that the jury was improperly instructed. So you can come at this thing from six different directions if you want to. I see the red light. Thank you very much for your attention and time.
Our thanks to both counsel and all counsel.